This Valentine's Day week on Art of the Air features indie folk cellist, vocalist, songwriter Ellie Barber, Olea, reviewing her new album, Antifragile, coming March 25th. Next, we feature the author of The Road Unpaved, Border to Border with a Brain Tumor and a Bike, Rissa August, about her journey of rediscovery after her diagnosis. Our spotlight's on Chicago Street Theater's farce comedy Rules for Living, opening February 14th.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Chicago Street Theater, Allison Granite, and she's going to tell us about their upcoming show and maybe a little bit about her own theater background and some of the things that are going on, maybe even in the summer. Allison, welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Hi, thank you. I'm excited to be on.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you. First of all, Allison, before we talk about the show you're directing, tell us just a little bit about your theater background and your relationship to Chicago Street Theater.
So I've been doing theater for a long time. I graduated from Valparaiso University with a theater and English double degree. And then, I did some work with court theater out of the University of Chicago for a summer or two. And then, after graduation, I worked at Steppenwolf Theater and I was in properties and scenic design and, with some background in directing that I did in undergrad, but I've helped and assisted here and there since graduation. My main love is being for properties and design, but I fell in love also with directing, and I've gotten an opportunity to work at Chicago Street Theater off and on over the last few years. I assisted directed Misery a couple years back with my friend Michael Glorioso, and I just remembered how fun it was to direct, and I pitched a few shows, and I kind of stumbled into getting Rules for Living, which I had the pleasure to see live when it first went up in London when I was an undergrad. And I just absolutely fell in love with the show. So it's kind of a quick synopsis of it, but.
When did you graduate?
I graduated in 18. So it's been a little bit, but I've been kind of hopping around doing freelance work here and there. I have a regular 9-to-5 too, but now I just kind of do this more and more on the side as I get around.
Well, just out of curiosity, what is your 9-to-5?
I am a local librarian.
Oh.
I'm a manager over at Porter County Public Library System.
Excellent. Esther, well, I am too, but Esther is a real fan of libraries, so she...
Yeah.
Yay! We love our libraries.
No, they're the best. So you were in... So it premiered like in 2015 in London, so you were there for that... Oh, gosh,
yep,
how lovely.
I saw the last night at the very closing night at the National Theater in their black box space, and I had just gotten tickets for like £5, because they were just trying to fill up the auditorium. And it was one of the coolest experiences I'd ever had. The theater space is obviously amazing. I had a chance to see two or three shows in it while I was there. And it was just really cool. And I just kind of was enamored and I immediately bought it in their gift shop area. And I haven't, I still, that's lent it out to everybody here in town to get, so that everybody could see how good it was.
Tell us a little bit about Rules for Living. It's a Sam Holcroft show, and tell us a little bit about the background of the actual storyline.
So it is your typical family like get together. The family comes together for Christmas luncheon dinner, and right from the get go, you have just a converging of family reunions. Of like, we first meet with Matthew and his new girlfriend who's coming home for Christmas for the first time. You get a kind of a sense that something's a little off there, but then you just have the family getting together, rivaling brothers. That's another kind of thing. And it's just everybody anticipating and preparing for luncheon and waiting for their father to come home who's been at the hospital. So as the family, if that's all happening, there's an added kind of Brechtian approach to it that the audience is clued in on. And there are these rules that people have to abide by and perform in order to not deal with the actual problems at hand. So Matthew, who is the son with the new girlfriend, he must sit to tell a lie. So every time during the show, if he's sitting, he's lying. And if he feels like he has to lie, he's got to sit at some point. So the rules kind of, everybody gets a rule and they kind of start stacking and getting more and more absurd until it culminates into this huge food fight at the end. And how you get to that train wreck is really the fun of it.
How long have you been in rehearsal?
We actually start rehearsal on the 16th of December. So we'll be heading into it soon. And then we will be going into about 2 months of rehearsal before we air.
Okay.
So, Allison, did you use like the traditional set, or how have you modified it?
So it calls for an open conservatory like setup with open air. I've stayed pretty lenient in, or like open to that. I'm also set designing the show, but I wanted to lean into the games aspect of the show a lot. And what I ended up doing is kind of looking to 70s game shows like Matching Game, Hollywood Squares, everything like that, and really leaning into the theatrics of that, because the audience gets to see all of those little quirks and tricks, not the characters don't know that's there. So it kind of is very 70s style home, like it's outdated, like the parents have not renovated. And there's elements that are very theatrical. So we have like marquee lighting that's going to flash when characters' rules are going. There's a projection that's going to have all of the rules live as they're racking up points, like a scoreboard. So it's going to be a little bit of that.
Sounds so wonderful.
And real quick, in our last moments here, tell us show name, dates, times, and location.
So the show is Rules for Living. It's going to be starting February 14th and running until March 3rd. And it's going to be at Chicago Street Theater, and you can get tickets there.
Okay, and that's chicagostreet.org, and you can email them at boxoffice@chicagostreet.org. And that's Allison Granite. She's directing Rules for Living there. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Art in the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker.
This is Jessica Lynn, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
Pleased to welcome Ellie Barber to Art on the Air. You've been listening to Tea Kettle Tea. Ellie is also known as Olela. She is a multidisciplinary artist. As an indie folk cellist, vocalist, and songwriter, she started her classical training on the cello at 9 years old. Olela blends the acoustic with contemporary, folk with pop, and tenacity with softness. She is a two-time finalist in the NPR Tiny Desk Contest in years 2022 and 2024 and has had music featured in film and TV. She also collaborates frequently. Her newest album, Anti-Fragile, will be released March 21st, 2025, a sweet way to start spring. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Ellie. It's really wonderful meeting you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
It's exciting.
Well, I first heard you, of course, on the Tiny Desk Concert, which I'm a fan of, and also my daughter was, and I thought, this sounds like a perfect guest for our show, so we're so glad that you agreed to do it. And how our format works is that we always want to know all about our guests, their background. I always say their origin story. So we want to hear about how you got from where you were to where you are now, because I know you have a great story.
Yeah, so it started very young. My mom says that I sang before I could talk. It was always kind of part of me. And I grew up in a family. My older sister played the violin and my mom played the piano, not professionally, but she was quite good. And so I started music very young. I started with the piano when I was 5 and started playing cello when I was 9. And just continued on the classical music path, basically, through college. I thought I was going to major in music, in classical music in college, and got kind of sidetracked by science. but ended up minoring in music in college. And then after college, I started playing with folk bands and started singing and playing with the cello simultaneously. And at that point, I'd moved from the Seattle area, which is where I'm from, to Colorado. And of course, Colorado has a very robust old time scene, lots of fiddlers, lots of bluegrass. And I was in a band with an old time banjo player. And so I picked up a lot of these fiddle style ways of playing the cello, just kind of worked my way through it of relearning how to approach the instrument from a classical standpoint to a kind of a fiddling standpoint. And and then I started Olela in February of 2020. That was when I officially launched it. And we all know what happens after that. So it kind of incubated for a couple of years. And in that time, I moved back to Seattle from Colorado. So that's where I am now in Seattle, and luckily now the pandemic has lifted, and it's a joy to be here.
Well, Seattle's another extremely rich artistic community. Actually, that whole part of the country is just filled with amazing artists. Well, okay, so now I have to talk about your 9-year-old self. And so how do you come upon cello at 9 years old? Like, explain that love affair.
Yeah, I had actually really wanted to play the flute at that time. And it was at public school in 4th grade, it was Choose Your Instrument Day. And so the orchestra teacher was doing the instrument trials. And she had already watched my sister play the violin ahead of me. And so she knew that my sister had this kind of natural knack for it. And so she tried me out on the flute and was like, you know, I don't know about the flute for you. You should really try the cello. And I was a 4th grader. I was like, okay, whatever. And I tried out the cello and I did really enjoy it. And she, I think, really encouraged me to pick it up. And it worked out really well in my family also, because my sister played the violin and my mom played the piano. So we had kind of this dream of having a trio in the household, which I think only realized a handful of times, but I did get to play some duets. Yeah.
So how did you feel when you had the flute though? When you had it, did it feel like you thought it would feel?
Gosh, I really don't remember much about it. I remember it being challenging to, like, strings felt a little more intuitive to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's because I was coming from the piano and it's a little more, it feels a little more mathematical to me, like the transition.
Right. It translates really well, doesn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. The piano to the cello.
Yeah.
And so then you, did you, what, your musical career in school then? So was there, it was a band, I'm assuming, and...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there we actually had a really solid orchestra program in public school growing up, which was amazing because I know that's not the case everywhere. And so I performed in orchestra through middle and high school and did a whole senior recital and that whole thing. And yeah, and then ended up going to college for music originally. Right. I went to the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma, Washington. And yeah, just continued on the classical track, and the alternative cello stuff really came in later.
You know, we opened our show with Tea Kettle Tea. Can you very briefly tell us the little story behind that? Because I think there is one. And then we want to start playing some of your stuff that you got coming out in your new album.
Yeah, Tea Kettle Tea is a very tender song. It's very close to my heart. It was about, or it is about, an aunt that I had that was, she was my first music teacher. She was the one that taught me piano when I was five. And she was a hand surgeon for musicians. She had quite a story. She was just very vibrant and musical and electric, kind of, and was sort of the second mother figure to me. And she passed away of stomach cancer when I was 11.
Ooh.
And yeah,
oh,
it was very sad. And I had always wanted to write a song about her because she was such a huge part of my musical trajectory. And it took about 10 years, I would say, of songwriting to actually be able to write that song. And it just kind of flew out of me. It felt like an anvil kind of from the sky, one of those that just passes through you. And it's a very tender song. It has been really special to share that one with audiences because it always brings me close to a stranger after the show. It's really special.
It's so interesting. And something that you said, I want to revisit it after, but could you tell us a little bit about Mothers in Colors, because that's what we're going to play next.
Yeah, this song is one we just dropped a couple weeks ago. And it's off the new album, Antifragile. Mothers in Colors is one that came from a place in my life. I'm in my 30s, and a lot of people around me are having kids. And my own sister had a kid within the last year. And so motherhood has been on my mind. I'm not a mother myself, but it's been on my mind. And this song kind of came out of the pondering of the enormity of motherhood, just the amount of emotions that mothers hold. And to me, in this song, colors is kind of the spectrum of emotions. But they, you know, mothers have such deep love and joy, and they also hold so much grief and sometimes trauma.
It's a very raw place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, why don't we take a listen to it right now from the Antifragile album to be released, Mothers in Colors, Olela.
Orange and red, green and blue, she's all of them, you and two. Once she split, she grew into two. How she did it, haven't got a clue. Everything in between, the whole damn rainbow.
and that was Olela, Mothers in Colors, on the Anti-Fragile album. It's a CD release and also an online release.
So what was the, you know, how did your sister feel about it? And have you heard from other mothers? Have you had response?
Oh my gosh, what a question. I think that it's all the things. I think that's what I've heard over and over again, is that it's so beautiful and it's so hard and it's so everything.
Everything.
And I think it makes me think about it as someone who, I've always had a desire to be a mother one day. And I think in the music industry, that's a particularly challenging thing to do. And I know a lot of women I know that do want to be mothers, you know, really think about this a lot, of what it means to be a mother in the music industry, and just how to balance everything, you know.
Sure. In fact, one of my favorite pregnant stories is watching, and it's a Tiny Desk story as well, watching Abigail Washburn, very, very pregnant, clogging, playing with her husband, Bela Fleck. It was just like so precious, and it was gorgeous. I mean, that shape is so beautiful, but then she's singing and clogging, and I don't know, it's lovely.
And you're right, family and touring, which I don't know how much touring you do. Maybe you'll want to talk about that. But trying to set up a family is a difficult thing. But how much touring do you do?
I usually tour twice a year. I've been focusing mostly on the West Coast and the Rocky Mountain region so far. But this year we'll be expanding that to the East Coast. And I'm still doing all my own booking, so I'm kind of limited by my own capacity when it comes to tour booking.
So when we were talking about Tea Kettle Tea, it brought up a question about songwriting for me. And so you said Tea Kettle Tea was kind of like, pow, there it was. And is that your typical way of entering into a song? Do they just organically or intuitively happen that way for you generally?
I find that it's usually, there's two different ways that I songwrite, that being one of them. Usually if there's something particularly emotional that I'm feeling, it will come out in a song where it's, you sit down and it just flows out onto the page and it's very fast.
Fast. And for me as a poet, if I don't grab it in that moment, it's gone.
It's so true. Yeah. I have so many voice memos on my phone because of that reason.
When you do that, do you like maybe use a recorder to maybe hum a tune, for example? Or, you know, what process? Do you sit at a piano or do you actually go to the cello to, you know, pick it out? Or, you know, what's mm-hmm. that process? Or does it vary?
Yeah, I would say generally it varies. But for me, I'm very melodically driven. And so it'll often come from the voice first. Mm-hmm. And I'll think of a melody that really is sticking for some reason. And I'll make sure to record that on a voice memo, and often we'll then put chords behind it and add the pieces. But for TKLT, it really was everything all at once. It was quite an experience, honestly. I felt like I was in a trance.
It's so magical because it's different for everybody. Like you think about Elton and Bernie and how the synergy of that, but then also like my daughter, when she will write a song, I mean, she's doing the music sort of at the same time, which is also just, I mean, so there's like so many different ways it happens for everybody. And it's just so magical to learn about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so true. I would say most of the time, probably 2/3 to 3/4 of the time, it's not that for me. It's more of I create some sort of deadline for myself and I work an hour a day to work out ideas, whether it's lyrical or a chord progression or melody. But I do love the feeling of just the catharsis that comes when it's fast.
And selecting an album, putting together the different elements of that, tell us that process. And then probably pretty quick here, we want to talk a little bit about Optimist also, and we want to play that.
Yeah, so there's 12 tracks on this album coming up, Anti-Fragile. And we went in with 15 tracks, thinking that we would record 15, pick our 12 favorites, and call it an album. And we ended up liking all of the 15 that we made, which was great. But it made it particularly hard to choose which ones go on the album, because of course, if you're printing vinyl, only so much fits on the vinyl. And so we ended up kind of grouping them. I think I'll probably release the other three later down the road. But we picked the 12 that felt the most cohesive and the most, obviously, our favorite tracks. I mean, the other three are great too, but...
Well, they're like your children. You can't really, you know, say, oh, which one I like best. But I guess at some point, especially if you're putting on vinyl, you have to do that. But let's go take a listen to Optimist from the Anti-Fragile album, Aloha.
I am an optimist, dream a lot, I make long lists, and sometimes I pull them off. He is a pragmatist, looks at the world just the way it is, doesn't waste time getting distraught. I never had considered, it's fine that we differ. No need to act under the gun. We sat down to dinner, shared a glass of liquor. Easy to take a side when you only know one. Ooh.
Optimist on the Anti-Fragile album, coming out in March, with our guest today, Ellie Barber, also known as Olela.
Yeah, I'm glad you kept that one on.
Thank you. Yeah, that one actually is a little bit different because it's not based in the cello, or I also write on the tenor guitar, the electric tenor mostly, and that's not on that song either. But I started it on the guitar, and I brought that song, Optimist, to the studio with my band, and it turned into a totally different song, which was such a cool process. And something I really enjoyed about the process of this album is just the collaborative nature. I held things less tightly on this album.
You know what I liked about it too? And there is that cohesiveness about it, but each track has its own unique sound to it. You know, you can tell it's the same artist, of course, but they're such different moods, which was very enjoyable to go through the whole album. Sometimes it's hard for me to listen to the whole thing from start to finish, you know, because you have your favorites. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was just really smooth to go through the whole thing from start to finish.
Well, we're getting into our final moments here, and we want to give you a chance to tell us about information about release, where they can find out, and of course, any touring events you might have coming up. This will air actually Valentine's weekend, but tell us about when you're going to be out so people can find you.
Yeah, so we're recording this before Valentine's Day, but on Valentine's Day, we're releasing our third single called At Rest, so that'll be out. And for any of you that are in the Seattle area, we have a single release show on February 15th. And our album release show is going to be at Seattle Town Hall in April 26th. And I'll be doing touring after that. I'm still narrowing in on the exact dates and times. But if you follow on social media, that's where I announce a lot of that stuff. And on my mailing list and on social media, I am at Olella Music. And Olella is spelled O-L-L-E-L-L-A. There's four L's. you can remember because in Spanish.
We'll have a link on your picture on our website also that will take you there. So that's Ellie Barber, Olella, and her new album is Anti-Fragile. We've heard some of the things from that. And of course, T-Title T from before. Thank you so much, Ellie, for coming on Art of the Year and sharing your arts journey.
Thank you both so much.
Yeah, thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
This is Carmen Vincent, filmmaker and executive director of Project Neighbors, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Rissa August to Art on the Air. Rissa is an award-winning author, gestalt practitioner, creativity connection coach, and athlete. She just released a book titled The Road Unpaved, Border to Border, with a brain tumor and a bike. This bike trip was from Canada to Mexico. These are her words. I believe in being kind to others, and even more so being kind to oneself. I believe that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I believe in soul connection. I believe every living being deserves compassion. I believe in second chances. I believe anything is possible. I believe in miracles. I believe we each hold the power to heal, speak, feel, and live authentically. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Rissa. It's really, really terrific seeing you in person.
Oh my goodness, I am over the moon to be here. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, Rissa, and you have such a great story to tell, but the first part of the story, besides your specific journey that you tell in the book, is we want to know your origin story. And how I say it is like how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us a little bit about all of your background.
Sure. So I grew up in a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, and a family of four, two parents, older brother, and, you know, typical upbringing. And I went on to go to school, college at Kent State University in Kent, Ohio, and got this bug for travel. I started traveling when I was 21 and kind of never looked back. And what I learned about myself was how much I loved experiencing life and culture and learning new things and learning about myself and the world around me. And so after a ton of travel and exploration, I got married and landed in Colorado, and that's where I'm based now.
Well, I want to take you back to like elementary school and even earlier. So what was the family like? Did you travel as a family? Were you writing then? What were you, you know, an athlete even at that, you know, at that time? We're sort of interested in what growing up was like.
Sure. Yeah. So I was probably a tomboy because my mom was working a lot, I remember, and I was always playing sports. I always wanted to be like around my older brother. And so I was always, you know, that meant learning how to throw a football and baseball and all the things and riding mini bike, like dirt bikes and stuff like that. And so I realized I had this passion for the outdoors and just being outside. You know, we played in creeks and made mud pies and all those things. My dad was really fascinated with history and culture. And I remember I'd find like coins from, you know, other countries and stuff you know, in his dresser drawer or something. And I remember him giving me a buffalo head nickel. And I was like astounded. I was like, this is the coolest thing. And I feel like it was kind of my first draw or connection to Native culture. And I just oh my gosh, I guarded it with my life. And he and I would watch like Indiana Jones movies. And that's it. I wanted to be Indiana Jones and be an archaeologist. And so that's kind of where that, I've had my dad to thank for that. It kind of opening me up to kind of the world that was out there beyond my small little town outside of Cleveland.
And adventure.
Yes, and adventure, yes. But we certainly didn't travel much as a family. My parents had a very tumultuous marriage, and I don't know, dysfunctional family dysfunctional is probably a word we hear a lot today. So it was what I knew and understood as a child. But my parents ended up getting divorced at a young age. I was around 8 years old. And mm-hmm. so we didn't do a lot of traveling, but my dad, would take us camping or to the bowling alley or, you know, out there, to, you know, do all kinds of fun things.
Sure. Well, you can have amazing adventures in your backyard. So
absolutely. I agree.
So when did cycling come into your life? I mean, I obviously all kids ride a bike usually at some point, but when you start maybe looking at that in a little more seriously.
Yes, it actually came later in life. I really got into the outdoors and most of my fitness was hiking and backpacking and camping. And it wasn't until probably my later 20s where I went back. I didn't finish my degree at Kent the first time around. I went back in my late 20s and finished my degree. And apparently I had a lot of exploring to do because that between that time was when I did a ton of my traveling. And so I when I went back to school, I got a part-time job as a lifeguard. And I started seeing triathletes come in. They would train for their kind of the swimming element of triathlons. And I remember asking a guy that I thought was really cute. And I said, what are you training for? And he said, a triathlon. You should try one. And I was like, oh, my goodness, I could never do that. I haven't ridden a bike since probably high school. So I was like, there's no way. And but I decided to accept that challenge. And so I did. I borrowed a friend's oversized mountain bike, learned to swim, started running a little more. And I finished my first sprint triathlon. And then it kind of took off from there. But biking was actually always my least favorite element. And I think that's because I felt stronger at swimming and running. And it wasn't until later in my life where I had no choice. I couldn't run. And biking suddenly became my most favorite thing to do.
Well, and cycling, as we well know, is a lot lower impact. You can, if you can't run and some other types of exercise, it's a pretty heart healthy exercise and everything. But, and also probably if you borrowed someone's mountain bike, that's probably not ideal for that type of competition. You know, it's a different kind of bike and everything. So as you probably got into that I know eventually you moved into higher end bikes.
So what was your degree in?
My degree, it's interesting. When I first started, it was business management. I had several people tell me, you can't be an archaeologist. You won't make any money. You won't get a job. So I went into business management and I blame that for being the reason I left school. I had no interest in it. And so, later in life, when I went back to get my degree, I got my degree in geography because I loved travel. I loved maps. And there's more than just maps to geography. You study all kinds of different cultures and social structures and immigration and emigration. And I was just fascinated by the world. And there's a whole physical element too, and why people settle in certain parts of the world. And so that really, really drew me in. And so, yeah, I ended up
that excitement. It is exciting.
Yeah.
So how did you go from not really riding the bike to doing this triathlon? What were the physical things that you needed to do to build up the strength?
Yes. Well, I definitely, like Larry said, I got a better bike, one that fit better. And that changed the game. I learned more about the sport and worked my way up to full distance Ironman races. And for any listeners out there who aren't clear on what Ironman races are, it's a 2.6 mile swim, 2.4 mile swim, excuse me, and 112 mile bike and a marathon run. And you do that all back to back in one day. And took me my first one about 15 and a half hours to complete. And I loved the thrill of it. I just loved, it was almost like you put your 10 months of your life on hold to train for this, all for the moment you cross the finish line. And so I don't know if I just, that's what drew me in and proving to myself what I was capable of. So, fast forward to, I think, were you asking me how I got to, sorry.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I've watched skiers in, like the summertime training, you know, and so I was wondering kind of, is it always training on just riding the bike? Because the skiers would be like there'd be steep stairs and they'd be hopping up those and, you know, to maintain their flexibility and strength.
Oh, yeah. So I had to essentially do two workouts a day. So usually I was at the pool at like, as soon as it opened at 5:30 in the morning, getting my swim in before work. And then after work was either running or biking. And then I would also work in maybe 2 days a week strength training. My day off technically wouldn't be a day off. It might be like hiking 7 to 10 miles, but it was a different form of exercise. So it definitely took a big commitment. And also figuring out, okay, what nutrition is going to work for me and what doesn't work. And so you quickly learn what doesn't work.
So during this time, I would kind of like to know when you started to feel that your body wasn't quite responding or feeling right. So at that point, were you feeling tired doing this and you just pushed yourself? So do you remember that?
Sure. Yeah. So following my first Ironman race, it was about a year later, a friend of mine asked me to do a 500 mile bicycle tour with her. And I was like, oh, yeah, absolutely. And so we signed up and we did the ride. It took about 6 days and I was really struggling. It was about a year later after this first Ironman. And I had put on a ton of weight, but I also wasn't recovering. It felt really hard. And I kept thinking, oh my gosh, okay, I must not have trained well or didn't train enough, you know, all those questions. I didn't think anything of it. I thought maybe I was just eating too much, but it started declining from there. I started going to doctors and like, hey, I think something's really, really off in my body. you know, I have inexplicable weight gain. I have kind of other strange things happening. Like a lot of things that you might chalk up to, like hormones or
stress.
Overtrain. You know, I heard a lot. Oh, you're overtraining. You train too much, or you're not getting enough sleep, or drinking enough water. It's kind of all these. They seem like generic symptoms, but that could connect to anything. But I knew, because I knew me and I knew myself and I knew my body. I was like, but not for me. This isn't adding up for me. So over a 7-year period of time, like I just kept doing my thing. I got really into CrossFit. I was riding my bike more. I didn't do another Ironman for a few years. And it wasn't until that next Ironman race that I barely got through it. I barely finished. I remember I fired two coaches because I thought they were assigning me the wrong workouts. I was like, I'm not recovering. You must be programming the wrong stuff for me. And I kept finding excuses for all this stuff that was happening. And so it wasn't until after my second Ironman race where I'm like, something's really wrong. I couldn't get off the couch. I thought I had adrenal fatigue and started looking at some of the things that might be happening in my body. There's such something called post-Ironman depression. I was looking at that. I thought that must be it. I can't seem to get off the couch. And then it took another year before I was finally diagnosed. I had such extreme headaches that I was barely sleeping 2 hours a night. And so that's kind of, I think, where that next journey begins.
Right. And then you have to tell us about that medical journey, that trying to find out what was going on. And you know, that kind of was a sense of discovery that the medical professionals that you were seeing just were not getting it. They weren't. And I think that's a lot of people have that complaint, is sometimes mm-hmm. doctors and those people don't hear. They just sort of do a prescribed, well, it's this, and this. But tell
or
us
they
about
say you're too young for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you're
to
too
be.
Young. Mm-hmm. So tell us about your discovery, how that finally came to be.
Yes. Well, I remember it very clearly. I typically actually didn't go see doctors, or I didn't even take ibuprofen. I was very much a naturalist. But I remember going to see my doctor, and I'm like, something is wrong. I'm barely sleeping. I have severe headaches. And she's like, I'm not worried. Your blood work's fine. You're a super fit. You're an Ironman athlete. Like I'm not worried. I said, well, I'd really like to get an MRI to rule things out. Like I'd like peace of mind. And she said, I don't think you need one. And I was like, well, I'd really like one. And she's like, no, they're expensive. You don't need one. And I don't know what, I think it was the first time I felt like I found my voice. I remember sitting in this doctor's office, and she turned her back to me to type something on the computer. And I said, order me the MRI. And she shook her head and she's like, all right, I don't think you need it though. And then it was 1 week later, I get the email with one sentence that says, you have an enlarged pituitary, go see an endocrinologist. I'm like, I have no idea what an endocrinologist is, but that propelled me to my life changed from there. I would never be the same person.
Yeah, but it took like having to be so forceful to have it happen, which I mean, and it's like that moment, that's your strength of character coming through, and that's what's gotten you to where you are now. Would you like to read apart from the book? Would
sure.
that be? Yeah.
Absolutely. This is from, I was actually going to read the chapter about how art came into my life actually through this journey, but I'm actually I opened up to this page about from the chapter 21 called Questions. And I'm going to just read a short snippet from there. As I get ready for bed, I find a painted rock at the edge of the flower bed near my tent. In colorful letters, it says one single word, trust. The profoundness of the moment warms me more than that hot shower ever could. I've been keeping to myself, trying to make the ride mine, because I don't trust any of these people with my story, the way the Flash trusted me with his. But what has it been like to be me in my life? Who is Rissa? And what makes her light up the way the Flash did when he talked about the people and the things he loved most? Well, I think, looking at that rock, I'm just a girl with a bike and a brain tumor. I'm a girl who has no idea where she's going. Being in my life has been hard, thanks, Bubba. But it's also been beautiful. I've seen some gorgeous places and met some amazing people. Some of them are even on this trip with me. I have no idea what's ahead of me and what's behind me. Definitely feels like something to pedal away from as fast as I possibly can. But this, tonight, it's been a moment. I will only ever live once. This ride is a ride I will only ever be able to take once. The time I spent with the Flash was a gift, and so is this moment, me staring in the dark at a rock. What has it been like to be me in my life? Sometimes I don't know how to answer that question, but I'm working on figuring it out.
It's beautiful. And for our audience, if they haven't, they read the book, Bubba is the name of what?
My brain tumor.
And you actually, in the book, without giving away too much, have developed sort of a relationship with it, a kind of a talking interaction, which is actually very, very interesting. And you're on this, and the other part of your book is you're on this long cycle ride from Canada to Mexico, and all these people that are kind of characters of different type, and how that weaves with your story. So I think that's
Yeah, pick up the book even just to see what Bubba's wearing.
Well, in our last few moments here, we want to give you a chance to tell how people can, first of all, find your book, find out more about you. I also know you do speaking engagements and things like that, and just to find out details about you and getting in touch with you, maybe to come out and speak or share your life journey.
Oh, thank you. Yes. So you can find out just about anything about me on my website, RissaAugust.com. That's R-I-S-A, August, just like the month.com. And I love all the parts of me and who I'm becoming. So I put it all there in my website. You can find my book and all the things I'm doing and all the adventures Bubba and I are going on.
It's an interesting relationship. And, you know, the frankness of how you share things in your book and also in the brief time we've had together is so interesting. And, you know, I would encourage people to get the book. It's called The Road Unpaved, Border to Border with Brain Tumor and a Bike. Rissa Auguste has shared that. It's available on Amazon, on Kindle, a whole ways. And I think there's also an audiobook version. So I appreciate it. Rissa, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your, well, cycling journey and your journey with Bubba.
So grateful. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. It's been such a pleasure talking with you.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell it to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker, and for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air. We rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Show the world your heart, express yourself through art, and show